The Problem of Evil, Part 3. The third talk in a four-part series was presented by Jack Crabtree on July 13, 2012, as part of Gutenberg College's 2012 Summer Institute, What the Bleep Can We Know? The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a non-profit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Okay. So we spent a chunk of time at the end of the last session looking at premise one. Premise one is the assumption that uncreated reality contains inexcusable evil. We looked at that from the standpoint of evil as such. And now looking at suffering as potentially a species of evil, we're going to focus on suffering itself. So we're looking at that same premise that that created reality contains inexcusable evil by asking whether or not there's inexcusable suffering in reality. So that's the next section. And when I say suffering here, I'm not going to make it. Oftentimes in philosophical argumentation, you'll have completely different discussions of physical pain as over against sort of psycho-emotional misery and suffering of some kind. I'm going to lump them together because I would answer them the same way. There are some distinctive things about them, but from the standpoint of the larger question that I'm asking, there's nothing to be gained by making the distinction. So by suffering, I mean physical pain or psycho-emotional misery of some kind. So the first point is it's fallacious to simply identify suffering with evil without qualification. And that's relatively easy to see. But it's fallacious to just say suffering is evil, period. Clearly, some suffering can lead to a greater good. So the problem of evil, for some people, often construes all the suffering in the world to be evil just as such. But that's wrong. Not all suffering, including physical pain, not all suffering is evil. I think people come to that conclusion by a kind of specious argument that goes on in their head that goes something like this. To cause suffering in another is to cause something that the other person doesn't want. By the golden rule, that's to fail to love them. To cause them to suffer is to fail to love them, because you're to do unto others as you would want them to do unto you, and you don't want to suffer. So to cause them suffering must be a failure of love of some kind. And to fail to love is evil. So therefore, to cause suffering is necessarily evil. Therefore, God, who causes all suffering according to biblical divine determinism, God who causes all suffering must be evil. But that argument is fallacious because a person can inflict suffering in order to achieve something good. And we see all kinds of examples of that. The dentist, the surgeon, causes physical pain, but they're not causing physical pain as an act of evil. Yes, they're causing physical pain, but they intend to do good in the very act of causing the physical pain. They're intending healing and good. Or psycho-emotional things. If a friend comes and tells me a painful truth, a truth about myself that's difficult for me to accept without it causing some kind of psychological pain, a friend who tells me a painful truth about myself is actually doing me good, not evil, because he's confronting me and bringing me up to speed on the truth. Or a parent who disciplines a child. The child may not like it, may have a psychological, emotional dislike and aversion to being disciplined on the one hand, but the parent should not hesitate to discipline them just because it's going to cause some kind of suffering. It's intended for their good. So that's easy enough to see, that we have to be really careful that we don't just automatically allow the person on the other side of the debate to just sort of get me to assume that all suffering is evil. No, all suffering is not evil. However, it doesn't follow that suffering that leads to a good outcome, like the dentist or the surgeon or the friend telling me the truth or the parent disciplining the child, just because suffering leads to a good outcome, that does not necessarily mean that the suffering is good. That doesn't follow. Because the problem that we have to face is, even if God uses suffering to produce good, could he have produced that same good without the suffering, that same outcome? If he could have, it's difficult to see how God is good to do it. So it's not sufficient to say, I see a relationship between God causing suffering in my life and having this outcome. Just because that relationship can be traced, that doesn't get God off the hook. Because I have to ask the further question, but what, could God not have produced that outcome without using this means of suffering? This is the means and end that Margaret was talking about earlier. If suffering is merely a means to a good end, that can't account for suffering. Because we're dealing with a God who can say, let there be light, and there's light. So that same God could have said, let there be sanctification, and there is sanctification. Let there be wisdom, and there is wisdom. Let there be maturity, and there is maturity. Let this person be a good person, and they are a good person. And without using any suffering as a means to the end at all. So if we think in terms of simply cause and effect, means and end, I don't think we're going to get an answer to either evil or suffering that way. And note that our concept of, and I'm assuming it's accurate, maybe I'm wrong, but I'm assuming it's accurate, that our concept of eternal life is an existence without pain and suffering, or at least without the most dramatic and egregious forms of pain and suffering. So something in us sees the absence of suffering as somehow inherently good. We see that as inherently good. That where we're aiming for is an existence where that kind of pain and suffering will no longer exist. Well, why do we have that concept? Don't we have that concept because at some level we recognize suffering as not a good, certainly not in and of itself? And I'm going to argue it can contribute to something that's good, but it's not good in and of itself. Okay, therefore, suffering that produces a good outcome is not thereby necessarily good. Ultimately, suffering must be inherently and intrinsically good somehow. The process that God is using is not, when he uses suffering, it's not that good is suffering is good because it brings about good. There has to be something inherently good about suffering being the process itself. Otherwise, I don't think we can accept that God is a good God who causes suffering.
So is that parallel to the idea of evil? That somehow evil mm-hmm. is good?
Right. And my contention is that suffering can inherently and intrinsically be good only by being meaningful. Okay, now once again, you see how crucial it is then that created reality has a narrative structure. I don't think it makes really a whole lot of sense to talk about suffering being meaningful outside of a narrative. Maybe I'm wrong, but at least given that God is telling a story here, that makes much more accessible to us the idea that within the story, the contribution that the suffering makes to the story is a meaningful contribution to that story being that story.
Jack, are you talking on an individual level that it must be meaningful, or I'm thinking more abstractly?
More abstractly. I mean, that is to say, it doesn't necessarily have to be meaningful to me, the sufferer. No, I wouldn't have to necessarily be able to identify the meaning. But what is critical to the argument is that from the standpoint of what God is creating, the suffering that I am undergoing makes a meaningful contribution to the story of, I think it probably has to make a meaningful contribution to the story of my life. But the story of my life, its meaning is going to be linked to and tied to other storylines as well.
Does it necessarily need to have a meaningful significance to my life immediately, or could it be something, you know, that you realize several years later?
later?
Several years later, and maybe never. See, it's not a question of whether I know the meaning.
Consciously can know.
Right. It's a question of whether it has meaning.
Okay.
Yeah, I may never. I highly suspect, we'll go to the end of our lives going looking back on some things that happened, though. Don't know what that was for. Don't know why that happened. But it doesn't, it's not up to me to invest meaning in. It's just a question of whether objectively it does have meaning. So remember throughout here, we're answering the philosophical objection to the goodness of God. We're not giving ourselves counsel so that we can get over our suffering. That's a different thing.
Could you include all natural disaster kinds of things, like mm-hmm. earthquakes, mm-hmm. as well as 9/11, major things like
yes.
that, where it's just you can't even begin to know all the suffering for the reason.
Right, that's right. Yeah, good point. By suffering, I mean man-made suffering that is caused by the evil of man, but I'm specifically thinking of things that men have nothing to do with. Just the natural disasters, you know, tsunamis, hurricanes, volcanoes, sharks, abominable snowmen.
Question about you said that God can create people with wisdom and he can create people with goodness and that kind of thing. And one of the arguments that I've heard against evil that's been semi-persuasive to me is the idea that it's important for us to know just how evil is. We imagine a puny kind of evil. If we don't understand how evil can be, we won't understand how good goodness can be and how terrible evil is. And I think it's, you know, evil is analogous to a hangnail when actually it's analogous to cancer, you know, something like that. If it's important for us to understand how evil can be, does it make sense to say that God, we don't need to have some knowledge of evil in order to direct knowledge, observe evil, or at least observe somebody else experiencing evil or something? God could create a person with the knowledge of evil who couldn't point out how he happens to know how evil can be. He just knows that it is. Just because there are some things we just know and we can't. Maybe certain things would end up being like the first principles that we just know that good is good and evil is evil and how bad and good that can be. Mm-hmm.
And the problem I have with all the arguments that say things like God couldn't have brought this about without that is, you know, some of those things are true. That is, we could never have an experience of evil without having an experience of evil. That's a logical contradiction to claim that somebody can have an experience of evil without having an experience of evil. So God can't do that. That's true. But so, then make a reality where people don't have an experience of evil. What would be the problem with that? And what we're offering it up to people as is an explanation for why God had to do created reality this way. Well, I think we're fighting on the wrong front because he didn't have to make created reality this way. I think we should concede that. Yeah, he didn't. He could have made it a very, very different reality. That comes back to our original discussion. Is there something about this reality that's more good than that other reality that I could imagine he could make? Well, I don't think we have to say that. Well, maybe not. But for whatever reason, a reason that's hidden in the mind and nature of God himself, He wanted, he chose, he preferred to create this reality. And maybe he's creating the others as well. Who knows? But as far as we're concerned, this is the one he created that I'm in. And I don't have to defend his choice of this reality as long as this reality is worthy of existence. And the fact that he chose this one over some other, well, okay. That's his doing, but it's not like what he created is not a good thing, unless it's not, and that's the issue. Is this reality have the evil and suffering in it that makes it something that should never have been brought into existence?
So if what this is fundamentally an act of self-expression, then one might ask, well, as an act of self-expression, is it sufficient unto itself, or does this book need a reader? If an artist makes a painting, does he need somebody to view it? Author writes a book, does he need somebody to read it? And I know I've written poems, for instance, that I never showed to anybody, and I didn't really care if anybody liked it, even if they did see it. And I'm guessing that's probably what God is doing.
Yeah,
otherwise,
exactly.
if part of the thing is he's written a book and he needs somebody to observe it, then we've got that problem of, if part of the purpose is for me to observe it, he couldn't create me with the sense of having observed it if I didn't observe it.
Yeah.
So I'm not really a necessary part. He doesn't really, the self-expression doesn't necessarily imply that he needs somebody to observe that self-expression.
Exactly. That's a very important point. Because most, you know what a theodicy is defending God against the charge of being evil. So what I'm doing here is a theodicy. Most theodicies in Christian history have one way or another made an argument that makes us the audience of God, and that somehow what God did was for our sake as an audience. That's a category mistake. That doesn't help, because if we are the audience, all he had to do is create us with an intuitive knowledge of what it is he needed to show us, and skip all the other stuff. If the knowledge by me in and of itself, or the appreciation by me, or the acknowledgement by me as the spectator, is his aim, is what he's going to, or another way that would have eliminated all this stuff. So it doesn't really answer the question, well, why didn't he eliminate all this stuff? It's critical to understand that, as far as we know, God does not have a brother. This is not, or any peer. There's no audience for this act of creation. It's simply and purely an act of creation, an act of self-expression for his own sake. And I think that's the best way to understand it. Otherwise, again, we get into a muddle in the way we argue and the way we talk about it. And I think that's very important. I mean, the fact that you can imagine yourself creating something that no one is ever an audience for, and that's just fine with you, that makes sense to me. I think that's the way we have to understand God.
If we were in the, not in this present stage, but in the theological or religious stage, would the expression in Genesis then have been complete in itself? And God said it was good.
So start over again, one more time.
If we were in the theological or religious stage where that was the accepted authority, which it isn't now, would the expression in Genesis have been acceptable and complete? What he says, it was good.
Yeah, I think so. If I'm understanding what you're saying, was there a time in history when culturally we were so willing to grant authority to the Bible and theology and so on, we would have been much more ready to accept, oh yeah, I don't know what all the suffering means, but I know that what he did is good. Is that what you're asking?
Exactly.
Yeah, I think so. I think that's probably true. It's not that you didn't have people in the Middle Ages beginning to ask these questions, but probably they would have been much more ready to understand what it means to just simply submit to God, even if I don't get everything that he's doing. Yeah, I think that's probably true. Do you think that's true, David? Or,
yeah. Oh, well, at least you, I'm on board with whatever.
Okay, let's push on. So C1, suffering can only be said to be good if it contributes significantly and meaningfully to a good story. And by that good story, I mean one that is meaningful, significant, good, true, reflecting the character of God. Suffering may bring about a good outcome and yet be evil if, in the context of the story of which it is a part, it is unnecessary, purposeless, senseless, or meaningless. So even if suffering could bring about a good outcome, but the suffering itself was purposeless and unnecessary, then it's evil suffering. inexcusable suffering. Not the fact that it brought about a good outcome doesn't justify it, doesn't cut it. Hence, it is the meaningfulness of suffering, not its outcome, that is the critical factor in whether it is evil. However, the outcome of suffering may very well contribute to its being meaningful. That is, in the context of a story, this meaning of the story may be to show the relationship between evil and suffering on the one hand and a good outcome, and that can be part of the meaning of the story. But it's the meaning of the story that's critical, not the outcome. Because there are other instances of suffering that are meaningful and the outcome is bad. My contention is that any unnecessary, because meaningless suffering would be inexcusable. I think that's true. Unnecessary, meaningless suffering is inexcusable. Reality, and therefore God, is good if and only if all the suffering in reality is meaningful. My contention is that suffering is meaningful if and only if the suffering in and of itself contributes to the goodness of the reality that he's creating. It's a good story. It's a significant and good and true story that contains the suffering. And what does the story mean? The suffering is inherent to the very meaning of the story. But it's a good story. That makes the suffering that is contributing to its meaning good, contributing to its goodness.
We use the analogy that Sam brought up with the picture, the whole picture, and we're not taking each brush stroke and evaluating it or whatever. It's when the picture is done, you look at the picture and you have this organic whole. If somebody were to look at the picture and say, I don't like that part, and I don't like that part, and I don't like that part, I think you should take that out. The painter might be able to say, okay, I could take those things out. And it's not necessarily the case that I would make it a bad picture, but it's not the picture I wanted to paint.
Right, that's right.
And I wanted to paint that picture for a particular reason. I didn't want to paint this picture.
Right.
And that's my project as the artist.
Exactly. Yeah. And like we were talking about earlier, I don't have to justify it. Painting that picture rather than that picture, as long as the picture I painted was a good one. So suffering is not good merely because it leads to a good outcome, as we've been saying. Meaningful suffering is in and of itself an element of what is good. So it's not a means to an end. It's an element of the goodness of the good thing that God has created. And then more importantly, suffering need not be desirable to be meaningful and therefore good in and of itself. All suffering is by definition undesirable, I would argue. If it weren't undesirable, we wouldn't call it suffering. But if it makes a meaningful contribution to the morally good story that it comprises, then it is good, even though it's not desirable. Jesus chose suffering in the Garden of Gethsemane, even though he did not desire it. And we know he didn't desire it because we've read the story. So he didn't desire it, but yet he chose it.
Why?
Because he agreed with his Father that it was a good thing that he obeyed the will of his Father. Now, there's several factors here, I think, that contribute to our perception, a false perception, but there's a perception that we have that it's just obvious that there's some suffering in the world that's meaningless. It's absurd. It makes no sense. It shouldn't be there. God knows better than that. And it just shouldn't be there. Now, we have a tendency to think, well, that's just obvious. And what are the factors that contribute to our thinking that that's obvious? One, A, here on page 9, belief that suffering is an ineradicable part of created reality and that therefore some of it must necessarily be meaningless and therefore inexcusable. There's nothing philosophically sound about this, but it's just sort of our sense that there's just too much of it that it just deeply embedded in the very fabric of reality. Surely, in all that suffering that is so deeply embedded in created reality that you can't remove it, some of it's got to be absurd. I think that's how a lot of people reason. And so the specious assumption is that the sheer volume of suffering in the world must necessarily entail that at least some of it's meaningless. But in fact, logically, it's certainly possible that all of the suffering in the world is meaningful. I mean, how do I know otherwise? On what basis can I claim that kind of knowledge that, no, I know that there's got to be some of it that's meaningless? Or we can have the belief that any and all suffering is meaningless and unnecessary if it does not result in a discernibly good outcome. So we put ourselves in a position of judge, and we look at the suffering around, especially the people that are close to us that we care about, and we ask ourselves the question, is there any good coming out of that? Well, if there's not any good that I can see coming out of that, then that shouldn't have happened. That was completely unnecessary, and that's absurd.
But how could you know? I mean, that's the problem.
Right.
I mean, we haven't seen the end of the story.
That's
so
right.
We don't know if it's good or not.
That's right. But if we're looking for evidence, we close off the investigation. We're going to stop here and draw my conclusion.
Well, some churches, some theologies seem to. I mean, that's what, when you're in the middle of suffering. You know, what is God trying to teach you?
Right.
If I could just learn it, maybe He'd stop beating on me.
That gets reinforced in the way we counsel each other. Well, there's a specious assumption there, too, that one can judge whether suffering is necessary or meaningful by whether it results in a beneficial outcome of some kind for the sufferer. I mean, there's really two problems. One, do you know what the beneficial outcome is? And secondly, as I've been arguing with the case of evil, maybe there's no beneficial outcome. But that's not the point. It's not the outcome that determines the goodness of it. It's something else. It's how it fits into the story. So in fact, the necessity or meaning of suffering must not be judged by the outcome, but by whether the suffering had any intrinsic meaning in its own right. Suffering can be necessary and meaningful irrespective of whether it brings any benefit to the sufferer. It's critical to understand that. But a good example of that is the punishment of moral evil. The punishment of evil does not result in a beneficial outcome to the perpetrator of the evil. But the punishment could indeed be meaningful nonetheless. And the fact the bad guy, the villain, gets punished is not good for the villain. The outcome for the villain could be horrendous. But I still, standing back and looking at the story, I go, that needed to happen. That contributed to this story in a way that makes it a coherent, orderly, substantive, meaningful story that ought to have existed.
So in essence, the suffering was meaningful, but not necessarily the person who
exactly.
was experiencing the suffering.
Exactly.
So there was still a good outcome there, but not for the individual.
If you call the meaning outcome, then yeah. Yeah, I'm using the word outcome specifically to distinguish it from meaning. So it is morally good to punish, to inflict suffering upon the perpetrator of moral evil. However, it is not good because the perpetrator is benefited by the punishment, but it is nonetheless a good thing. We'll talk a little bit more about that later because that'll have to come up again. And then, and this is probably the most important part of my argument on suffering, I would argue that there are four human realities that distort our perception of human suffering in such a way that we believe that we see all kinds of instances of absurd, meaningless suffering in the world. We think we are empirically observing them. But my contention is it's a distorted perception that lies behind our belief that we have seen absurd suffering. There are four things. The first one is empathy, a distorted perception that results from a built-in, God-given instinct of empathy. We are hardwired to feel that the suffering of another person ought not to exist. And it's just instinctive. I mean, it can be brutalized out of us, I suppose. But if empathy is brutalized out of me, or like in the case of a sociopath, if I just don't have it, I'm somehow deficient as a human being for my lack of it. So a normal human being is hardwired to feel that the suffering of another person ought not to exist. And I would imagine that the reason that God gave us this instinct of empathy was to move us to act. So this is in order that we might be moved to seek to alleviate the suffering of the other person. If I feel the ought not to existness of it, that can then be a motivation for me to do something to make it so it doesn't exist any longer. So I move to alleviate suffering. I think that's probably God's purpose in giving us that instinct. But the feeling created by empathy is not moral knowledge. And that's the critical thing to understand. It's not a moral judgment that is being handed to me instinctually. It's a feeling designed to motivate me. It's not moral knowledge or moral judgment. It's human feeling. And I just have a note here. Empathy helps move us. It gets us going. It causes us to feel the rightness of loving others. It causes us to feel the goodness of showing tangible, concrete help, aid, love to others. It causes us to move from knowing what would be good to do to actually doing the good that would be good to do. I think that's its purpose. If we confuse empathetic feeling with moral judgment, then we will necessarily, but I think fallaciously, judge all suffering to be absurd and meaningless. We would judge any and every instance of suffering as absurd, because it feels like none of it should exist. And I hope you can identify with this, that, I mean, do you ever like to see people suffer? I mean, don't you always wish you had a magic wand that you could just make it go away, make it disappear? Because it makes me uncomfortable that other people are suffering. It's human, it's right that we feel that way, it's purposeful that we feel that way, but just because I feel that that thing shouldn't be, doesn't mean that it shouldn't be. From the standpoint of the story and God's purposes and what he's trying to create, no, it should be there. It needs to be there in order to have the meaning and significance that God wants to create. So my feeling is out of sync with what is true, and it's certainly out of sync with my moral judgment and my better philosophical judgments.
And my feeling may be out of sync with that suffering needing to happen.
Right.
And that's where I get tangled up. So if I step in to alleviate suffering, I may be getting in the way of what God has intended for that suffering to accomplish.
Exactly. And that's where you see there is a negative side to empathy. Because sometimes I fail to love a person because I'd rather alleviate their suffering than do what's good and right in the relationship. That's why what's important is that not only do I think about God out of right moral judgment rather than empathy, but I also love others according to love, not according to empathy. I shouldn't act toward them the way that feels what's the word I'm looking for?
Nice.
I shouldn't be driven by my feeling of empathy, but I should be driven by my wisdom of what do they actually need. In order to promote
their own. Major obstacle in training counselors who want to rush in and make the person feel better, and they may need to suffer for a while.
Exactly.
And it's knowing when to let that empathy play itself out.
Yeah, that makes all the sense in the world to me. Yeah.
And a very common parental mistake.
To what?
A very common parental mistake.
Yes, right. Absolutely. Yeah.
Can I
kind of
go to the little topic? You can understand not soft by soft. But I think that the feeling then could also bring us to the point that we just simply be a presence with that person. You don't have to alleviate the suffering. You just know they're not alone, and that they have that sense.
I shouldn't think so.
I don't, because it seems to me that that's one of the aspects of what this does, is bringing that sense of the other.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can't think of any negative outcome to letting the empathy, as you put it, make me connected and present with them. Sure.
Was
Okay, and this is closely related to that, but the second one is a distorted perception due to human instinct, and that I would put actually parental instinct in here. We are hardwired to strongly desire the happiness and well-being, for example, of our children, if we are. That's our parental instinct. With every cell of his body, the parent wants his child to be safe and unharmed and happy. But the desire created by this instinct does not constitute moral knowledge. It's a human feeling. Parental instinct is notorious for its tendency to distort a person's ability to truly love his children. Children get spoiled because a parent allows his need to make them happy overrule his judgment about what would actually be good for them. The parental instinct is satisfied by the child being pleased, even if the actions that please the child ultimately destroy his character and being. It is not an act of love to destroy a child's character. That is why being guided by parental instinct can be actually contrary to love.
Is that why necessarily give us like everything that we want, the instant feeling without, you know, at least in this version of the story that he's written, I wouldn't necessarily just hand us everything without making some meaningful.
Right. Yeah, because because his goal is not to make me happy and please me.
All the time.
His goal is to make me a substantive, good, well ordered human being. That's his goal. So again, if we confuse any instinctual desire, and it doesn't have to be parental instinct, it could be any other biological instincts that we have. If we confuse any instinctual desire with moral judgment, then we will necessarily, but again fallaciously, judge any suffering endured by one I love instinctively to be unnecessary and meaningless. And that would be a mistake. Just because I don't like what's happening to my child does not mean it's unnecessary, absurd, and meaningless. Okay, another one, even more powerful, I think, is a distorted perception due to horror and revulsion. I think we are hardwired to feel revulsed and horrified by any and all suffering and to feel that anything that revulses us ought not to be. But my feeling of horror at the revulsion toward evil, or I should have your suffering, I think, toward suffering, is not moral knowledge. It is human feeling. My revulsion, for example, at the gruesomeness of a gruesome automobile accident is really no different than my revulsion at the gruesomeness of some murder. But clearly, they are not morally equivalent. The one, they both involve horror, but one was an act of evil and the other was not. And yet it doesn't change my instinctive revulsion at what it is that I have witnessed or what it is that I see. I don't mean to be too quick. Well, never mind. If we confuse revulsion with moral judgment, then we will necessarily but fallaciously judge any and all suffering to be absurd and meaningless, for all of it is horrible. All suffering is horrible. The infliction of suffering in the condemnation of evil is a very instructive example. Suffering, while being totally repulsive and undesirable, can nonetheless be good because it's morally meaningful, as in the case of punishing, forcefully, violently punishing an evildoer. I cannot judge God to be good when he punishes an evil person, for example, Satan, and at the same time, that's supposed to be judge, not just, and at the same time judge the infliction of suffering on another to be evil. So it's not at all uncommon for people to think, for example, take the opponents of capital punishment. What's the compelling core of their argument? You're being violent to another person. You're treating them violently. You're inflicting pain and suffering violently on them. And if you just automatically rule that out, that ought not to be, period, then how could there be any punishment of evil? And then let's take it out of a social political environment. God, for example. How can God punish evil if he can't be violent toward it? add my, that note there. My own moral judgment is that it is right and good that moral evil be punished. And by punished, I mean met with force and violence against it, that moral evil be punished. The Apostle Paul clearly believes the same. He believes that the fact that God punishes evil men is compatible with, indeed, even essential to, God's moral nature. In Romans 3, 5, and 6, Paul asks rhetorically, God, when he deals out wrath, is not unjust, is he? I mean, when he deals out wrath in response to the individual. Of course not, Paul says. Otherwise, how could God judge the world? If God can't be violent in his reaction to evil, how can he judge the world, Paul said. How could Paul approve of God dealing out any wrath at all? How could any force and violence directed toward evil men be good? The only possible answer is that the punishment of, that is, the use of force and violence against evil men, is morally coherent, morally meaningful, and morally significant, and morally significant act that ought to exist in a morally good reality. And in fact, Paul's point is, if it didn't exist, it wouldn't be a morally good reality that God had created.
It is interesting that people who fight against that kind of thing, many times they can't even grant the possibility that there might be some function for punishment per se. The common argument is, you know, we're going to execute a murderer, and they say, well, it won't bring the dead person back.
Exactly. And see the mistake they're making? They're not thinking of it as a narrative. They're thinking of it just simply in terms of an outcome. Does the outcome erase the evil of this outcome? Okay, then I guess it's not meaningful. I guess it's not significant. I guess it has no place. Well, but in a morally ordered reality, if evil goes unpunished, there is a loss of order in the reality, a loss of moral coherence to the reality that's been created. And that's why you punish.
And in effect saying it's okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's a lie.
Yeah. Or I will tolerate the incoherence. So this example of punishing moral evil, morally evil people, highlights two important insights. One, our moral judgment with regard to suffering must be understood to be distinct from our visceral human reaction to suffering. Moral judgment is one thing, visceral reaction is another thing. And I can't just easily and directly and automatically translate my negative visceral reaction into a negative moral judgment. Just because I don't like it doesn't mean it's wrong. Just because I don't like it doesn't mean it's evil. But that's such a common mistake that people make. The use of force and violence against the punishment of evil men is a morally coherent, morally meaningful, and morally significant act, and it ought to exist in a morally good reality, and yet any humane human being will have a visceral reaction wherein he is repulsed by it. You know, you take the movie where the villain is as evil and as cruel as he can be, and in the end, he gets skewered somehow or smashed to smithereens or something really mean, nasty, and gruesome happens to him. We have two reactions that are simultaneous. Who? And hey. And we have both reactions. The one is my moral judgment making me react. The other is my visceral horror and revulsion at any sort of evil, suffering, at any sort of gruesomeness. It's just a visceral reaction. Yuck. Goo. We don't like it, but we like it. But in that case, the reason we like it is because moral order is being restored. That's the kind of person who should be met with that kind of outcome, with that kind of reaction.
So but we wouldn't use that concept and say any violent response is to evil is a just response. I think our institution would prohibition is cruel and unusual, but you know, put the bad guy who's, we took Hitler, who's, you know, the classic, or Marquis de Sade, you know, heinous, terrible, bad guy, worthy of death, you know, no question. And we ordained that instead of simply hanging him or shooting him or throwing him off a cliff or whatever, we're gonna do some of the Marquis de Sade tortured people to death. We're gonna torture him to death too. I think that's a problem.
Yeah, the problem though is, again, we have to make a distinction between God and us, and I'm mostly concerned about God here, not.
Yeah, would you say that for God to torture people forever and ever is that would be consistent with his good moral character?
No. Yeah, it wouldn't be just to have a punishment that's out of proportion with the evil, with the
one that could argue though to be a rebel against the eternal good God justifies just about anything. Although what doesn't match is the significance of the being doing it. If this was a God fighting against God, maybe something like that would be necessary. But it's a human being,
right.
A copy.
Right. Yeah. I'm only finitely evil.
Yeah.
And then the second one. We have to distinguish between visceral reaction and moral judgment. And the second important thing that example highlights, the example of punishing an evildoer, is there's an important difference between objective moral goodness and benefit for a particular person. And we've already seen that. We've already talked about that. So I'm gonna press on for the sake of time. Fourth thing, and this is important as well, the distorted perception due to imagination. This is a critical one. Human imagination is on the one hand a wonderful gift and also, as we all know, a terrible curse that we all have. But human imagination can cause me to feel that I see empirically and empirically having empirical evidence of what in fact I don't see at all. But I think I see it because I made it up. You know, I imagined it to be what I think it is. And why that's particularly important here is that human imagination can cause me to see the absurdity and the meaningless of another person's suffering, even when, in fact, that is not absurd and it is not meaningless. But I think I see that it is because I imagine it to be meaningless. And you have all kinds of arguments trotted out by people where they basically invite you to use your imagination, and they stipulate, here's this person undergoing absurd, meaningless suffering. How can a good God do that? A good God probably can't do that, but does any exist? Is there any real person who's undergoing that meaningless, absurd suffering? I can imagine it. I can stipulate in my imagination that they're undergoing this kind of suffering, and there's no point to it. I just stipulate that. There's no point to it. Now I have to justify God for something I made up. You know, I created it, and God's being blamed for it. It's my imagination putting something in place that I have no idea whether there's actually any real person in the world who's undergoing what I'm imagining. That's the problem with the brothers Karamazov and Ivan Karamazov, is he describes it in such a way, he builds absurdity into his description. And then you go, yeah, well, who does God think he is? Well, but what would actually be going on if there were actual people in real life having to live through that? What would be going on? What kind of inner dialogue might be going on between the creator and the creature that makes what they're undergoing inherently profoundly meaningful? Well, we just dialed that out with my imagination. I just imagined that out of existence. Well, of course, if I vacated of all meaning, then it's meaningless. But what gives me the right to vacate it of all meaning in my imagination? I'm no longer looking at reality as it is and looking at the empirical evidence. I'm just making up a fantasy world and deciding to react to that. So you see the importance of how this can distort it. This really came home to me. I used the example when I was at Reformation Fellowship. This really came home to me in a dramatic kind of way when I was in Jerusalem the first time. We were going to go through Hezekiah's tunnel, and it was very different than when we went to Israel. It was just sort of, you know, vacant lot near there, and not many people went there. It was a new, it wasn't a routine stop for travelers and pilgrims and stuff. And there were a bunch of Arab children just playing in this empty lot, and they were having a great time. They were laughing and the camaraderie and the playfulness of them. And but they were as poor as could be. They were just in pretty abject poverty. And my thought was, don't you have a clue how miserable you are? Come on, you guys. Get with it. You're supposed to be miserable. And then they came up and started talking to us about the $6 million man. That was a TV show at the time. And
they weren't that poor.
Well, they didn't have TVs, but wherever they could go to see. And you know, they had a childhood just like any childhood. You know, this is partly an American front. We are so prosperous that we can't imagine being happy without being rich.
Well, exactly.
But we assume they go together, and that there isn't something that's just common to humanity that allows us to make our own happiness in whatever state that we find ourselves in. That just is unimaginable to us. But that was a very dramatic demonstration to me that a child is a child. And they're going to play, even if it's with a wadded up paper bag, they can still play soccer. You know, they're just going to do what they're going to do and make their life as happy as they know how to make. Now, I don't want to minimize the suffering in the world, because there's that, like I said, there's that other side of us, that empathy that just breaks your heart when you see the conditions that some people have to face. That's right. And if we can alleviate it, we need to alleviate it. But that's a far cry from what their life and existence that has been dealt to them by God by saying it's absurd and it's meaningless and it ought not to exist. That's an entirely different judgment. If I let my imagination speak, of course I'm going to see it as meaningless and absurd because I just make it up. So all those, let's see, human imagination can cause me to see the absurdity and meaningless of another's suffering even when it is not meaningless. Seeing the world through the lens of human imagination leads me to see a world full of absurd, meaningless suffering, but note it is always the suffering of others that is so clearly absurd and meaningless. Rarely, if ever, is my own suffering obviously meaningless to me. I mean, in my experience, never has my own suffering been meaningless to me. But I can't speak for other people. But I have never looked at my own suffering and said, this is just absurd, this is just meaningless. I've wished it would go away, but I've always known that there's something meaningful happening that I'm having to come to terms with. Well, why can I not extrapolate to others and expect that God is doing the same thing in them that he does in me? Why would their suffering be meaningless when mine is not?
Would Rwanda be an example of Part B here? The genocide that took place in Rwanda.
Yeah. I mean, we look at that from afar and we go, there's no way that makes any sense at all.
Yeah.
That's right. And then when called upon to kind of ponder it and consider it, we just try to imagine what they went through. Imagine what they experienced. Well, if you imagine what they experienced, you know, it, in very broad strokes, you forget to put in the meaning piece. you forget to put in the people being called to repentance to their Creator, people being given opportunity to show incredible heroic compassion to other people. I mean, all kinds of ways in which there could be all kinds of meaning in the midst of that experience, that I don't dial that in my imagination. I just see it all as unmitigated, unqualified absurdity.
The same thing with the Holocaust.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and by the way, I meant to mention this a little bit earlier. If you've ever read Viktor Frankl, I haven't, but I've had students who have read Viktor Frankl and talk to me about it. But it sounds like an incredibly interesting stuff, because he, talking about the Holocaust as being a victim of the Holocaust, victim in the sense that he was in the death camps, seeing people go to their death in the death camps, And his conclusion was that the suffering there was meaningful, and that in fact the meaning of human existence is to find meaning in the suffering of human existence, or something, something roughly like that. And that, I mean, I think he's probably been the most profound, done the most profound analysis of suffering in probably anybody.
I just have two comments. The first comment is, in the midst of suffering, I'm not sure the meaning is always obvious. I mean, that's the meaning is most different from me. My other question is, in my experience, I have worked with individuals who have such a sense of being a victim, especially in this culture, aren't in that place that they've been seeing me, and I'm not sure they will ever be in this place to see that. Of meaning within themselves, purely because their view of themselves as a victim stops them.
That's right.
Is that also, is that make sense?
Absolutely. Oh, absolutely. Okay. Yeah, and remember again, it's not me knowing or discovering the meaning. It's whether or not, what's critical to the issue of whether God is good is whether it objectively has any meaning to it. Whether I see it or not, that's another question. And one of the ways that we don't see it is we don't want to. In human rebellion, there are going to be some of us who, there's no way we're going to admit God's good. We're no way we're going to bow the knee to God. And one of the ways we're going to defend ourselves against him is we're going to imagine that all the suffering he brought into my life was meaningless. And can we do that? Sure. We can, in our desire to be the poor, pitiable victim at the hand of God, in order to justify ourselves before God, we can take that perspective if we choose to.
But again, looking at it from a philosophical point of view, that is not true.
That's right. That's right.
But the, I knew you were a hard man, reaping where you didn't sow, and that kind of thing, and I knew that you'd come down on me like a load of bricks if I lost that talent. So I couldn't take a risk. It's your fault that you don't have a return on your talent.
That's right.
I didn't lose it.
That's right.
You can't beat me up for that.
Yeah. Exactly.
I have a quick question.
Uh-huh.
What's the difference, if any difference, between suffering and like evil? If we're talking about?
Well, in the way that I'm talking about it, suffering doesn't necessarily be something that results from an evil choice by a human being. So anything that doesn't result from an evil choice by a human being but is undesirable and unpleasant, that's what I'm calling suffering.
Okay.
But you're right, much evil does result in suffering in other people, in which case it's both suffering and evil at the same time.
Okay, so disease and something like that is an example of a suffering that isn't produced by evil.
Right, exactly.
And some suffering is a result of just natural consequences of our own poor choices.
Mm-hmm. That's true. In which case, there really is evil operating as well. Well, if they're evil choices.
Mm-hmm.
So all four kinds of distortions here, empathy, instinct, imagination, horror, and revulsion, all four of those distorting lenses are in our perception. The distortion results from substituting human feeling for rational moral judgment, or I'm stretching maybe to call imagination feeling, but putting some rational product in place of moral judgment itself. Everyone can agree that our human feeling towards suffering ought to be to reject it, to be repulsed by it, and to desire to alleviate it. So note, however, that the argument from evil contends that our rational moral judgment should be that God is evil. And that I won't deny, and it's not like Christians like suffering more than non-Christians do, or theists like evil more than atheists like evil. No, of course we hate it just as much, and we would wish it to be gone just as they do. But we refuse to make the rational moral judgment that God is an evil being for having created it. That's the difference. So what I'm saying is the biblical worldview assumes a certain priority of reason and knowledge over passion and feeling. If we compensate for the distorting effects of our natural feelings and instincts, it is not at all clear that our rational moral judgment can know that unnecessary, meaningless suffering exists in the world. Now, we live in an age where there are people who probably would quibble with that. No, what I feel is truer than what I know. I can't help them. I just think that's wrong. We have to go with our rational judgment. Now, the belief that even if all the suffering in the world could be shown to be meaningful, we could believe that the amount of suffering in the world employed to create that good and meaningful story is just simply too much. It's excessive. So that's another way in which we could argue it's just obvious that there's meaningless suffering in the world, or meaningless because excessive. Again, that there's a specious assumption there that the sheer volume of suffering in the world must necessarily be morally inexcusable. But in fact, it's certainly possible that the amount of suffering in the world is not at all excessive. That is, the goodness of the reality that God is creating is not somehow negated by the sheer volume of suffering that is contained within it. And I think that no human being has any standpoint from which he could possibly make the judgment that I know that it's too much. I know that it's excessive. It could be. Yeah, it's possible. But how would I know? From what possible place could I claim to have that kind of position to judge? So in summary, we do not have a standpoint from which we could possibly claim to know that the suffering we see in reality is inexcusable. That is, we do not have a standpoint from which we could know that the suffering in the world is either meaningless, unnecessary, or excessive. An assessment of the evil and suffering, now I'm taking both, evil and suffering, an assessment of the evil and suffering in the world leads to an impasse. Perhaps there exists inexcusable evil or inexcusable suffering in the world, maybe, but it is equally possible that there does not exist meaningless, inexcusable evil and suffering. We don't have a standpoint from which we could make that judgment. We would have to know the whole story of reality and have access to the inner experience, not just observe outwardly people suffering, but understand what is going on inside them. We'd have to have access to the inner experience of every human creature in order to have an adequate standpoint from which to make such a judgment. And my argument in the end is that would have to be a transcendent standpoint to be able to have such a standpoint. Okay. Let me pause there for 2 minutes. Have any questions before we take a break, and then we'll finish this after the break.
The futility that Paul says God subjected, the whole creation groans, subject to futility. Would you say that futility is the cause of some suffering? And would you, how? It's not a moral evil.
No.
How would you...
It's not in and of itself the moral evil, but that's the kind of the point that I was making about our concept of eternal life. It does seem to be an evil of sorts. That is, it's something that would be better not to exist. We were... Actually, Margaret and I were talking about an example of... she was going out bird hunting and saw a mother skunk and, six babies. And it was just a really beautiful sight. And then came back, the next day?
Three of them were torn up, and two of them were hiding in the bushes, and there was one missing, and the mother was no way inside. Clearly, the group had been attacked, and it was awful.
Yeah. So our reaction is the horror of the violence. The various things click in that are instinctual that tell us that's not the best thing to be. I mean, what a way for the world to be.
It shouldn't be.
Huh?
It shouldn't be. Like,
yeah. And I think that's true, because our judgment on God's creation shouldn't be, this is just wonderful. No, it is marvelous. It is amazing. It is delightful in a lot of ways, but it's also tragic in a lot of ways. Why a created order where things have to be destroyed in order for other things to go on living? What a weird thing. Why a reality where, as Jesus himself puts it, he creates a set of beings, human beings, And he says, there are vessels of wrath prepared for destruction and vessels of mercy, prepared for glory. There's two kinds of ends in store for these creatures. And then Jesus comes along and tells you, you know, the road to eternal life is exceedingly narrow and few go down that way. There's a whole lot more vessels of mercy prepared for glory than there are vessels of wrath prepared for destruction. You look at that and go, what a tragic reality. But that's just it. You know, when we get distance from it, is that a problem? If God wanted to create a tragedy, is it not his right to create a tragedy? And it's not, I don't mean a tragedy, because obviously it's not fully a tragedy, but a reality that has this deep and profound tragic element to it. And that tragic element is not just confined to what God is going to do with human beings, but creation itself. Somehow our whole sense of creation itself is, wouldn't it be better if people thrived if people didn't live on the death of others? If one being didn't live on the death of another being? That's the way this world is, but I think that's part of the futility and the corruption and thing that's just built into God's created order. But it's only temporary. It's this phase of what God is doing in the story. But that's going to give birth to a whole new heaven and earth, a whole new created order, where we are no longer subject to the corruption that is true in this earth. And it's just one big metaphor and picture of the nature of the story itself. That is, it's a story of redemption, where God is going to take that which would be better really not to exist and turn it into that which is really good that it exists.
And from that point of view, this will be seen to have been light momentary.
Exactly.
Yes, please.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think that's the perspective that we have to take on it and have to understand, is that I think, as Paul was putting it, when we get to see where he's taking us, we're going to look back and go, wow, that was all worth it. That this makes everything that has led up to now all worthwhile.
And that could be a fifth one of the realities that distort our perceptions about suffering, is that we think so temporally.
Yes, good point. Exactly.
Say that one more time.
Our short-sightedness.
We think temporally. We think about this world only. That what's important is what's happening now in our lives right now.
Great point. If you don't mind, I will.
I don't mind.
Okay, should we take a break?
Mm-hmm.